Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1134. BioPsyop Apocalypse Now, part 9. And this is miscellaneous updates on COVID-19. This is being recorded on June 15th of the year 2020. As the title of the program indicates, this is going to be updating a number of different considerations in connection with the coronavirus, and it is the, well, I guess we're going to begin by taking a look at a couple of, an article about two pieces of disinformation vis-a-vis the COVID-19. One of the things that I find interesting is that despite not only the full court press against China on the part of the U.S., but also the full court press by America's allies, NATO, its European allies, etc., and despite pointing the accusing finger at China about the coronavirus, the discussion is basically that the virus, the established theory is that the virus was not made in a laboratory. As we have seen, it is possible to make any virus in a laboratory at this point in time, and there have been any number of people, including a number of doctors and scientists associated with GM Watch, a British publication critical of genetically modified organisms, that have pointed out a number of ways that an organism, that the virus could have been synthesized. They seem to have, the GM Watch people seem to be blind to the possibility that that could have been made in the West. And the others are all saying, nope, couldn't have been made in the laboratory. I find that interesting at one level and suspicious. I suspect that many of them, suspicious at another level, I should say, I suspect that many of them are aware of what I believe is the fact that this was, in fact, made in a laboratory in the West, almost certainly in the U.S. And yet, I think that they are unwilling to admit that this virus was synthesized, partly because they may be afraid of a Chinese information counterattack, to coin a term. Also, I think that given the enormous amount of money that is at stake in connection with this, they don't basically want to ruffle the feathers of the goose that is getting ready to lay an enormous golden egg, in particular for Big Pharma. They're also, if it could come out, or if it would be reasonably demonstrated that it was an American laboratory that where this was synthesized, it would also lead to all sorts of diplomatic problems and lawsuits as well. Interestingly, there was a story that came out in the Daily Mail of the UK that had some information about a virus that this is from the Daily Mail of June 9th, and the title of the article is, actually the June 4th, excuse me, the Daily Mail is a UK paper, Spy Chief in Coronavirus Storm. Downing Street hits out at former MI6 boss Richard Dearlove's, quote, fanciful, unquote, claims that COVID-19 was made in the lab. This is by Larissa, L-A-R-I-S-A, Brown. And I think it is sort of odd that the head of, basically the Downing Street of the Prime Minister's office, is dissing Sir Richard Dearlove, who is a former chief of MI6. He came out and endorsed a report that we're going to talk about. And many of the scientists, however, who were associated with this, came out and said, nope, and it basically was discredited. We are also going to look at another report that came out earlier in April, also maintaining that the virus was made in a Chinese laboratory. And as we will see, this report was crafted by the Epoch Times. That is put out by the Falun Gong cult, which has many, many connections. It is a fascist mind control cult with links to the BBG, a CIA derivative organization, the Broadcasting Board of Governors. It also has strong links to the Trump campaign and to Steve Bannon, who is the spider, so to speak, at the epicenter of the anti-China web. Again, the article is from the Daily Mail in the UK from June 4th, and about the report that was championed by Sir Richard Dearlove, D-E-A-R-L-O-V-E, a former MI6 head, and was then dissed by the British government. A former MI6 chief was yesterday accused by government officials of peddling, quote, fanciful, unquote, claims that coronavirus was accidentally created in a Chinese laboratory. British security agencies believe COVID-19 is not a man-made virus and is highly likely, unquote, to have occurred naturally and spread to humans through animals. And Health Secretary Matt Hancock said there is, quote, no evidence, unquote, to back up the theory that it originated in a laboratory. But Sir Richard Dearlove, who was head of the MI6 from 1999 to 2004, cited a recent report claiming that the disease was accidentally manufactured by Chinese scientists. Quote, I do think that this started as an accident, Sir Richard told the Daily Telegraph's Planet Normal podcast. It raises the issue, if China were ever to admit responsibility, does it pay reparations? I think it will make every country in the world rethink how it treats its relationship with China. He added, quote, look at the stories of attempts by the Beijing leadership to lock down any debate about the origins of the pandemic and the way people have been arrested or silenced. The paper, co-authored by Professor Angus Dalglish, D-A-L-G-L-E-I-S-H, a renowned oncologist and vaccine researcher who works at St. George's Hospital, University of London, and Birger Sorensen, B-I-R-G-E-R-S-O-R-E-N-S-E-N, a Norwegian virologist, contains none of the stark allegations that originally stunned its reviewers. The initial paper that triggered wild rumors failed stringent tests of verification and is understood to have been rejected in April by eminent international journals such as Nature and the Journal of Virology. Biomedical experts from the Francis Crick Institute and Imperial College London are said to have refuted its conclusions. Then one of the paper's co-authors, Dr. John Frederick Moxnes, I may be mispronouncing that, M-O-X-N-E-S, chief scientific advisor to the Norwegian military, asked for his name to be withdrawn. This week, after numerous rewrites, the paper was published by the Quarterly Review of Biophysics Discovery, and those original world-shaking conclusions have now withered to innuendo. No accusation of Chinese manipulation appears. And another, we're going to kick this around briefly in just a minute. Back in April, a slickly produced investigative documentary tracking down the origin of the Wuhan coronavirus was released online. It claimed conclusive proof that the COVID-19 virus had been created as a biological, quote, weapon of mass destruction, unquote, in the Chinese lab. At first sight, it seemed a shockingly convincing piece of journalism. On behalf of this newspaper, I cross-checked every claim, the experts it cited, and the factual evidence unearthed. I also researched the backgrounds of its makers. I then approached some of the world's best independent scientific authorities to ask their opinion. They all agreed this enticingly spicy story just didn't stand up. It had been produced by a U.S.-based anti-Chinese government media organization called the Epoch Times. Its, quote, experts, unquote, were veteran hard rightists. Most damningly, its scientific, quote, facts, unquote, were twisted out of shape. So much, then, for the Chinese-manufactured coronavirus conspiracy. Well, the Falun Gong, as we looked at in, among other shows, for the record, 1089 and 1090, is a fascist mind-control cult that is, well, it's about as out there as any of them. The guru, or the head of the cult, is believed to have divine powers. He can walk through walls and levitate, and also plays a Falun Gong, an actual physical quote, law wheel or swastika in the abdomen of followers, which then revolves in clockwise and counterclockwise fashion and helps to regulate their physiology, spirituality at all. He claims that he can cause post-menstrual women to begin menstruating again, and that that is necessary because post-menstrual women, women who have experienced menopause, are considered to be spiritually decadent or unworthy or something along those lines. He also believes that people of mixed race and the gay people are inherently inferior, and that there are tiny little beings from space who have inhabited human beings and have brought about the invention of things like computers and airplanes and other things. It's interesting to see a group like this championed by elements in the West. There was a puff piece in Wired magazine about the Falun Gong people being a bunch of plucky sort of internet Paul Revere types. And it has been backed by, among other organizations, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is a CIA derivative. It also is very closely connected to Donald Trump's campaign and to Steve Bannon, who is coordinating the anti-China effort. It is interesting to see the coverage alleging, you know, that the Chinese covered up the epidemic when it first broke. I would hazard a guess that there was a lot of discussion about just exactly what was to be done. My guess is that the Chinese authorities probably realized fairly early on that they were under biowarfare attack, and then there was a decision about how to go about reacting to it and how to react to it in a public/diplomatic sense. At a fundamental level, however, though, this is a baffling organism. One of the reasons I think that there is not only cross-vectoring going on, but genetic manipulation. The epidemiology is extraordinary. There is a something like a 270-degree variance in infectivity. There are various different strains that have prevailed and then have retreated. The number of different symptoms, roughly half of people who have been infected are asymptomatic. People who have been infected and become symptomatic can become symptomatic or begin demonstrating symptoms in anywhere from 2 days to 2 weeks. And the symptoms themselves are highly varied. The virus, in addition to affecting the upper and lower respiratory tracts, appears to attack the T cells. It produces blood clotting, strokes. It attacks the heart, the kidneys, the central nervous system, has been linked to a form of dementia. It also has attacked the male reproductive system, produces skin rashes, COVID pose, some sort of loss of both taste and smell. It has been linked to a symptom called hypooxidity, in which the level of oxygen in the blood is incredibly low, more than should be possible without the people collapsing or showing some serious signs of respiratory interdiction. There is an infant or pediatric inflammatory syndrome, COVID toes. The point being that when you have a half of the people who have been infected asymptomatic and all of those varied symptoms, it certainly would take a while for anyone to gain a handle on this disease. Indeed, well after it was known and has been become a global pandemic, scientists and doctors are still trying to figure out many, many things about it, what it does, how it travels, how it mutates, how it produces that wide variety of symptoms. So when one sees the assertion that the Chinese covered it up, my guess is it took them a while to figure out just what the hell is really going on. Also, there has been a lot of disinformation in our media. I will go into this in the future program, talking about the yellow journalism peril, to coin a term. One brief example, I'm sure almost everyone in the audience heard about a Chinese doctor who was supposedly arrested. He supposedly had discovered the coronavirus, then was arrested for talking about it, and subsequently died at the age of 34 about the virus. Well, A, he wasn't the guy who discovered it. That was actually a female doctor. B, he wasn't arrested. C, he was disciplined, however, for tweeting about it without authorization, which does not, under the circumstances, appear all that unreasonable, given the firestorms of disinformation that have already exploded globally about the coronavirus. But keep an eye on things like the Epoch Times and weird reports like that, that the Chinese accidentally manufactured the virus and it then got out. This is part of what we will talk about when we talk about the China-killing virus, and we place the coronavirus / COVID-19 phenomenon in not only the full-court press against China, but against the background of a number of other different covert operations, or in the case of the National Endowment for Democracy, overt operations that have already gone down and been recorded. In For the Record programs 11-11 and 11-12, we talked about the fact that not only is Steve Bannon at the epicenter of the anti-China effort, he has been networking with, among others, with J. Kyle Bass, a wealthy Dallas investor who has been positioned investment-wise asymmetrically to the economies in both Hong Kong and China. And the aforementioned J. Kyle Bass has in the past been a co-investor with a guy named Tommy Hicks Jr. Tommy Hicks Jr. is a Trump official, White House, very close to Donald Trump Jr. He also is co-chairman of the Republican National Committee, thereby networking with many of the other one percenters who are the foundation of the Republican Party, what George W. Bush referred to as his base, the haves and the have-nots. He also, Tommy Hicks, that is at the epicenter of the interagency governmental networks that are coordinating in the anti-China effort, including CIA. So when you have people like J. Kyle Bass in the position to make a lot of money from the economies in China and Hong Kong, and when in turn he is networking with people like Tommy Hicks Jr., who knows, for example, what organizations like the National Endowment for Democracy are going to be doing in Hong Kong or vis-a-vis the World Uyghur Congress or the Uyghur World Congress, the NED having been co-founded by William Casey in the 1980s, it places this group of people in a unique position to invest in such a way as to make money from some of the operations and machinations which they in turn are controlling. And in turn, with Tommy Hicks Jr., he is networked directly with the Trump administration and the campaign, and the Epoch Times and Falun Gong are deeply involved with the Trump administration as well as with covert operations against China. Now, Steve Bannon, someone we have spoken about many times. By the way, I made an error in an earlier show. I described his primary influence as being Julius Evola, an Italian fascist whose work was financed by the SS at the end of the Second World War, during the closing stages of the Second World War. Evola was an influence, but I was confusing, I was conflating Evola with another fellow who wrote a book about a Muslim invasion and takeover of Western culture. So do note that, although Evola is an influence on Bannon, I was conflating him with another fellow. Bannon allegedly left the White House in 2017, but that use of the term allegedly is, well, apropos under the circumstances. From the New York Post of May 9th of 2020, Steve Bannon is quietly creeping back into the White House by John Levine. Donald Trump's lightning rod 2016 campaign boss and former White House chief strategist, who was banished from the West Wing in 2017, has quietly crept back into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, reestablishing ties to staffers, particularly with regard to his pet issues of China and immigration. Another former administration official told the Post that Bannon never really left the White House after he was fired, maintaining contacts and keeping up regular channels of communications with officials there. I suggested in the past that something like this was the case, and that Bannon is really something of an eminence grise or gray eminence. He never really left the White House, and he has remained an abashed champion of Donald Trump and his administration. Now, one of the things that I want to talk about before we get into the politics and the big money that are behind the or affecting the development not only of drugs to treat COVID-19 or the SARS-CoV virus that produces it, but also vaccines. One of the many things that I find very strange about the virus, and something that I spoke about directly in For the Record 1128, concerns the epidemiology. We are being told that the American outbreak of COVID-19 came from New York City, and that because New York City is a travel hub, it spread from there all the way across the U.S. In other words, New York City is the epicenter of the American outbreak. In a future program, we will talk about the fact that this virus appears to be one that is hitting the blue states or Democratic states much harder. The strain of the SARS-CoV-2 that arrived in New York and then spread out from New York to the rest of the U.S. came from Europe, and I am extremely skeptical about this being a natural phenomenon. I suspect that the subway may have been one of the vectors used, but the New York Times story from May 7th of 2020, travel from New York City seeded U.S. outbreaks. This by Benedict Carey, C-A-R-E-Y, and James Glantz. New York City's coronavirus outbreak grew so large by early March that the city became the primary source of new infections in the U.S. New research reveals as thousands of infected people traveled from the city and seeded outbreaks around the country. The research indicates that a wave of infections swept from New York City through much of the country before the city began setting social distancing limits to stop the growth. That helped to fuel outbreaks in Louisiana, Texas, Arizona, and as far away as the West Coast. I suspect that New York City was, in fact, vectored. I think other places may have been vectored as well. We'll talk more about this. If, in fact, we are to believe that this is a natural phenomenon, it is a safe bet that the strain of the virus originating in Europe would have come into New York via air travel. New York is a major travel hub with major airports. Newark, LaGuardia, and JFK. However, we have not seen reports of a large degree of infections or many infections, a high degree of infectivity in flight attendants, and that would be something that would be expected. In fact, airlines have been hard hit by the lockdowns, and there has been a lot of discussion about how airlines and air travel can be safely conducted, because in a long flight, people are packed in very, very close together, and unless they have masks, which they certainly would not have had in the initial alleged infection from Europe, I should say, to New York, the fact that we have not seen a major outbreak among flight attendants is one thing that I find, well, frankly, negating of the official version. I also want to emphasize that I think that many of the experts, perhaps almost all of them, are not necessarily being cynical. They're dealing with what they have, and for them to begin weighing the possibility that not only is this biowarfare, but that we have basically engaged in something of a bio-false flag operation in this and many other countries, well, that would be outside of their purview, and it certainly, again, would not help them to gather some of the golden eggs that the goose is going to be laying vis-a-vis this pandemic. There is a lot of money to be made in this, and at some point I'm going to replay For the Record 557, one of our visits with Ed Haslam, author of Dr. Mary's Monkey, and he discusses how the effect of the enormous amount of grant money vis-a-vis HIV and AIDS affected some of the lack of critical assessment of some of the ludicrous epidemiological presentations that became accepted, quote, truth, unquote, in connection with AIDS. I would just cite one of them. The official version of how AIDS came to the U.S. was basically a lone nut, if you will. Lee Harvey AIDS. It was actually allegedly a gay airline steward named Gaetan Dugas, D-U-G-A-S, who flew around and had sex with a whole bunch of people and basically became sort of a gay Typhoid Mary, if you will. In other words, the phenomenon of the outbreak of AIDS in the U.S. was attributed to a lone nut, and that just does not stand up. We'll talk more about that when we talk about Ed Haslam's assessment, when we present Ed Haslam's assessment of how chimpanzees supposedly were the source of the original development of AIDS as a human disease. There is a new and very important book out about Lyme disease, and presents a very convincing case that Lyme disease was in fact developed as a biological warfare weapon. We'll talk about that in future programs. The book is called Bitten: The Secret History of Lyme Disease and Biological Weapons. It's authored by Chris, K-R-I-S, Newby, N-E-W-B-Y, published in hardcover by HarperCollins, and copyrighted 2019. And in the book, and again, we will talk more about this in the future, on page 185, she has a rundown from a book by Z.F. Dembek, D-E-M-B-E-K et al., Discernment Between Deliberate and Natural Infectious Disease Outbreaks. And what the main clues are: potential epidemiological clues to a deliberate epidemic. 1. A highly unusual event with large numbers of casualties. Well, check. higher morbidity or mortality than is expected. Morbidity is disease. Mortality, obviously, is death. And I think we could check that as well, although, again, this is a very strange bug, and there may be cross-vectoring going on. The antibodies that have been demonstrated in many tests may be antibodies from another coronavirus, and then low levels of those antibodies could make someone infected with the SARS-CoV-2 much, much sicker than usual. But the higher morbidity or mortality, I think we can check that too. Clue number three, uncommon disease. Check. Clue number four, point source outbreak. Check. We're told that the entire outbreak in the U.S. came from New York. I heard anecdotal evidence in on the West Coast back in January, specifically on January 22nd. I was at a social event, and someone who was to attend did not show up and said that they had gotten this strange disease that was going around in which they had lost their sense of smell and taste. I had heard nothing about that up to that point and heard nothing else about it for a good 2 months after that. So I figured, well, you know, whatever. That, it now turns out, is one of the many, many weird symptoms of SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19. This was in January. So if it was going around in the Bay Area in January, I just find it impossible to believe that that was a strain that came from New York, which in turn came from Europe. Just does not compute. And the last clue, clue number five, multiple epidemics. And there have certainly been epidemics in many countries, and some countries have experienced second wave outbreaks. So again, from this paper by Z.F. Denbach et al., discernment between deliberate and natural infectious disease outbreaks. One, a highly unusual event with large numbers of casualties. Check. Two, clue number two, higher morbidity or mortality than is expected. I think we can check that. Clue number three, uncommon disease. Double check. Clue number four, point source outbreak. Definitely in the U.S., supposedly coming from New York. If in fact that is the case, I think there were multiple areas vectored in the U.S., I think it is highly unlikely that this was a natural phenomenon that was brought almost certainly via air travel into New York from Europe and that then spread in the U.S. from that point. And clue number five, multiple epidemics. There certainly have been epidemics in many countries and second waves. So the bulk of the clues for a potential deliberate epidemic, I think, check out here, and that is something that is not to be discounted. I was going to do something at some length. There is a paper that we spoke about in For the Record 1128 in which I hypothesized that, in fact, not only was New York vectored, but very possibly the antecedent of New York in 1965 having been vectored with a harmless bacterium would have been used, was in fact revived to vector New York City with a not so harmless virus. In that program, again, For the Record 1128, presented some excerpts from an article from Vanity Fair magazine from October of 2003, The Message in the Anthrax. It was by Don Foster. I'm going to deal with that at greater length in the future. I think that the anthrax attacks in the U.S. were not only in all probability a provocation, and we will speak about that in some detail, but I think the provocation had at least two levels of effect to it. One, it was used to help justify the invasion of Iraq, and two, it led to an enormous increase in the financing of the BSL-4 labs in the United States. And those labs are the high security labs that basically appear to be the state-of-the-art epicenters for the development of biological warfare weapons. Many of them are ostensibly civilian, but they have dual use. We spoke about that at great length in several different programs. But the article, The Message in the Anthrax by Don Foster, talks about how the development of how the anthrax attacks led to an enormous increase in funding for BSL-4 labs and for, quote, defensive, unquote, biological warfare research in the U.S. From that article, several of America's bioweapon news have said for the record that the anthrax attack has an upside. The killings have forced long-awaited FDA approval of the Bioport anthrax vaccine facility and prompted increased federal spending on biodefense by $6 billion in 2003 alone. But the anthrax offender also diverted law enforcement resources when we needed them the most and wreaked havoc on the U.S. Postal Service. He has shown the world how to disrupt the American economy with minimal expense and how to kill with minimal risk of being caught. Now that it's been done once, it seems likely to happen again. We will talk again about the anthrax attacks at greater length as a provocation or false flag operation to not only justify or help justify the invasion of Iraq, but to spur an enormous increase in funding that could be used for biological warfare. Recapping something that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, an article from Newsweek of December 5th of 2007 by Jeanine, J-E-N-E-E-N, Interlandi, capital I-N-T-E-R-L-A-N-D-I, High Stakes Science. The article notes, before the anthrax mailings of 2001, the U.S. had just two BSL-4 labs, both within the razor wire confines of government-owned campuses. Now, thanks to a tenfold increase in funding from $200 million in 2001 to $2 billion in 2006, more than a dozen such facilities can be found at universities and private companies across the country. China has one. The U.S. has 12. Europe has 12. Taiwan has 2. China only has 1, but they are planning on expanding to 5 to 7 by mid-decade. I suspect that what we are looking at is a clandestine biological warfare arms race with the Chinese, very much as the Chinese and before them the former Soviet Union were doing, were trying to do as much as they could to catch up to a West and the U.S. in particular that was way ahead. From that same Newsweek article, but some scientists say that argument obscures the true purpose of the current biodefense boom, to study potential biological weapons. The university, that's Boston University, portrays it as an emerging infectious disease lab, said David Ozanoff, O-Z-O-N-O-F-F, a Boston University epidemiologist whose office is right across the street from the new BSL-4 facility. But they are talking about studying things like smallpox and inhalation anthrax, which pose no public health threat other than as bioweapons. The original NIH mandate for the lab indicated that many groups, including the CIA and Department of Defense, would be allowed to use the lab for their own research, the nature of which BU might have little control over. One of the things that I think we should keep in mind is that as this enormous increase in funding for biological warfare development, a tenfold increase between 2001 and 2006 was going on, Donald Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense, as he was during the invasion of Iraq. Before that, he was Chairman of the Board of Gilead Sciences, which is the company that makes Remdesivir. We spoke about them at great length and covered them in many programs, and in particular, we spoke about them in For the Record, program number 1131. Now, one of the things that I want to do briefly is we're going to get into discussion of not only the latest results of Moderna's vaccine development, but the politics behind that and the politics behind the championing of remdesivir, which appears to have a relatively modest positive effect on hospital stays, but does not affect mortality apparently at all, at least not from what we have seen so far. And the politics, and in particular the money involved in the development of not only drugs to treat COVID-19, but also vaccines, is something to keep in mind. We will conclude our discussion with an article from the New York Times that explores the possibility that Donald Trump could come up with a COVID-19 vaccine October surprise, and that he could basically announce that, yep, there is a vaccine that will prevent the coronavirus or prevent infection, and that this could basically put him over the top in October. But now some of the, reviewing quickly some of the politics about remdesivir. An article from Stat News from May 11th of 2020 by Matthew Herper, H-E-R-P-E-R, inside the NIH's controversial decision to stop its big remdesivir study. Now, bear in mind, as we spoke about, on April 29th, there was an enormous an announcement of success for an NIAID trial of remdesivir, and that spurred an enormous increase, a huge surge in the stock market, and Gilead Sciences' stock went up as well. That same day, April 29th, Joe Grogan, a key Trump administration official involved with the development of the administration's coronavirus policy, resigned from the House, from the White House, and previously, before joining the Trump administration, he had been a lobbyist for Gilead Sciences. Now, from this Stat News article, about the timing, now bear in mind, this is April 29th was when Joe Grogan resigns. That's when the announcement is made that drives the markets upward. But the change in the study's main goal also changed the way the study would be analyzed. Now the NIAID decided the analysis would be calculated when 400 patients out of the 1,063 patients the study enrolled had recovered. If remdesivir turned out to be much more effective than expected, quote, interim, unquote, analyses would be conducted at a third and two-thirds of that number. The job of reviewing these analyses would fall to a committee of outside experts on what is known as an independent Data and Safety Monitoring Board, or DSMB. Note that originally there were 1,063 patients. They cut that to 400. Now note the chronology and bear in mind that April 29th was when the announcement was made. That's when former Gilead Sciences lobbyist Joe Grogan resigns from the Trump White House. And note the timing here of the DSMB. But the DSMB for the remdesivir study did not ever meet for an interim efficacy analysis, Lane said. That's the head of the NIAID, the National Institute for Allergies and Infectious Diseases, who has been monitoring, not the head of it, but the fellow who was in charge of this analysis. All patients had been enrolled by April 20th. The data for a DSMB meeting was cut off on April 22nd. The DSMB met, and on April 27th, it made a recommendation to the NIAID. That decision, Lane said, led the NIAID to conclude that patients who had been given placebo should be offered remdesivir instead, something that started happening after April 28th. Then April 29th, the meeting, the announcement is made, the markets surge, Gilead Sciences stock surges, and Joe Grogan, former Gilead Sciences lobbyist, resigns from the Trump White House. Now, there was a group calling themselves scientists to stop COVID-19. We spoke about that in the For the Record program number 1132. Some key articles from Fortune magazine: The Venture Capitalist at the Center of the Coronavirus Fight by Lucinda Shen talks about the fact that Brian Sheff apparently got his financial gravitas through, not Brian Sheff, but Tom Cahill, through Brian Sheff and through Peter Thiel, one of the top, quote, scientists to stop COVID-19, along with people like Michael Milken. Another article from the New York Post, April 28th of 2020, scientists and billionaires team up to aid White House in coronavirus battle. This is by Mark Moore, from the New York Post of April 28th. But now note what one of the things this group was doing from the Hill blog of April 28th of 2020. Elite group of scientists and billionaires are working together to fight the coronavirus pandemic by Alexandra Kelly. Well, one of the things they were doing, scientists to stop COVID-19 recommends that in this phase, the first phase, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, should work to coordinate with Gilead Pharmaceuticals to focus on expediting the results of clinical trials of remdesivir, a drug identified as a potential treatment for COVID-19. The group also recommends administering doses of the drug to patients in an early stage of infection and notes that remdesivir will essentially be a placeholder until a more effective treatment is produced. And still more, quote, government entities and agencies appear to adhere to the recommendations outlined by the group, with the journal, that's the Wall Street Journal, reporting that the FDA and the Department of Veterans Affairs have implemented some of the group's suggestions, namely relaxing drug manufacturer regulations and requirements for potential coronavirus treatment drugs. And Gilead Sciences, the manufacturer of remdesivir, is a major holding by hedge funds, including and especially Renaissance Technologies, Robert Mercer's hedge fund. We have spoken about that at some length. And then bear in mind again that on April 29th, the same day the announcement was made, after the NIAID and the DSMB dramatically attenuated the remdesivir study, Joe Grogan, a former Gilead Sciences lobbyist, leaves the administration. We have also spoken about Moderna, a company that gets DARPA funding. They have an untried vaccine that is a messenger RNA vaccine. It has never been used, such a vaccine has never been used on human beings. And for the record, 1132, we spoke about many problems with the company. Note that the head of Operation Warp Speed, that is going to be pushing the development of a COVID-19 vaccine, is Moncef Slaoui, who formerly was head of product development for Moderna. Also note that DARPA has been heavily involved with gene driving, the study of the research into gene driving technology, which can enhance the genetics of some groups and exterminate others. One wonders, this is pure speculation, but I wonder whether there might be some gene driving technology involved with the Moderna mRNA vaccine. Note that in addition to Moncef Slaoui, former head of Moderna's Product Development Committee, there is a four-star general, Gustave Perna, and that he was appointed to help expedite the vaccine by General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who has been under fire for his fatigue-dressed jaunt with Donald Trump across Lafayette Park for that photo op in front of the church with the Bible and the recent disturbances. Bear in mind also that as we looked at in 1132, Moncef Slaoui has many, many links to the pharmaceutical business. From the New York Times, article by Sheila Kaplan, Matthew Goldstein, and Alexandra Stevenson, Trump's vaccine chief has vast ties to drug industry, posing possible conflicts. In agreeing to accept the position, Dr. Slowey did not come on board as a government employee. Instead, he is on a contract receiving $1 for his service. That leaves him exempt from federal disclosure rules that would require him to list his outside positions, stock holdings, and other potential conflicts. And the contract position is not subject to the same conflict of interest laws and regulations that executive branch employees must follow. And he has many, many holdings in GlaxoSmithKline, a company that he formerly headed. Virginia Camper said of him, quote, "This is basically absurd," said Virginia Camper, who's chief ethics counsel for Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. "It allows for no scrutiny of his conflicts of interest." And note also that the Moderna vaccine is now under expedited development. It basically is being pushed rather quickly, shall we say. In addition to the aforementioned Monsef Slowey with all of his conflicts, there has been a study of Moderna's mRNA vaccine that has been concluded on mice. Now, note that one of the problems with the vaccine, if it produces low levels of antibodies, that can actually produce a more severe disease when someone becomes reinfected. That's called ADE, or antibody-dependent enhancement. It is one of the things that has to be avoided. Now, an article from Reuters from June 12th of 2020, Moderna COVID-19 vaccine appears to clear safety hurdle in mouse study by Julie Steenhuysen, Steenhuysen. It points out that in mice, it appears that the Moderna vaccine does produce levels of antibodies that are sufficiently high to avoid ADE. However, it is a study that has been criticized. "This is the barest beginning of preliminary information," said Dr. Gregory Poland, P-O-L-A-N-D, an immunologist and vaccine researcher at the Mayo Clinic, who has seen the paper, which has yet to undergo peer review. Poland said the paper was incomplete, disorganized, and the numbers of animals tested were small. Poland, who was not involved with the research, said the paper leaves out, quote, "important parameters," unquote, "that could help scientists judge the work." But one of the problems with the research is that it is going too quickly. The phase one research we spoke about in, for the record, 1132, and that was heavily criticized, in 1131, I should say, that was heavily criticized by many, many people as being deficient in many ways. Phase two, with 600 volunteers, is underway at the moment, but the results will not conclude until November. From Time Magazine of June 11th of 2020. Moderna plans to start phase three testing of its COVID-19 vaccine candidate in July. On June 11th, biotech company Moderna announced it had finalized plans for phase three testing of its COVID-19 vaccine candidate. The trial will test just one dose level of the vaccine, 100 micrograms, given in two shots. Now, the problem is that this will not test for low antibody production. It could produce a eugenic vaccine in which older people will not produce high levels of antibodies. They will produce low levels of antibodies. That will leave them open to very severe infection should they get the disease, should they become reinfected. Now, again, the animal trial is going on. It has produced good results so far, but has been criticized by people like Dr. Poland. Already before the phase two trial of 600 people, phase three is going to begin this summer. This is very rapid. No human vaccine has ever been approved for development, for administration to human beings in less than 4 years. And this is a novel type of vaccine. Again, the articles are talking about the animal study, Reuters, June 12, 2020, and the article talking about phase three trial scheduled to begin sometime this summer. It has been finalized it's announced on June 11th that it will begin that trial in July. But the phase three trial will only deal with one dose of the drug, and that will not necessarily test effectively whether ABE or an insufficiently low level of antibodies will be produced by the vaccine. That could leave older people devastatingly subject to reinfection. Now, again, the hurrying up of this with the animal trial is still underway. Phase two is still underway. Phase three is going to begin before phase two is concluded. Those results for phase two will not be in before November. Now, consider the following. This from the New York Times of June 8th of 2020 by Ezekiel Emanuel and Paul A. Offit, OFFIT. Could Trump turn a vaccine into a campaign stunt? In the desperate search for a boost, he could release a coronavirus vaccine that has not been shown to be safe and effective as an October surprise. Then hypothetically, they point out, October 23rd, 2020, 9 a.m. With 10 days before the election, Fox News releases a poll showing President Trump trailing Joe Biden by 8 percentage points. October 23rd, 2020, 6 hours later, 3 p.m., at a hastily convened news conference, President Trump announces that the Food and Drug Administration has just issued an emergency use authorization for a coronavirus vaccine. Mr. Trump declares victory over COVID-19, demands that all businesses reopen immediately, and predicts a rapid economic recovery. Given how this president has behaved, this incredibly dangerous scenario is not far-fetched. In a desperate search for a political boost, he could release a coronavirus vaccine before it had been thoroughly tested and shown to be safe and effective. And talking about the, by way of comparison, by comparison, the phase 3 effectiveness trial for one rotavirus vaccine, Rotatec, to prevent diarrhea involved about 70,000 infants from 2001 to 2004, and another rotavirus vaccine trial, Rotarix, involved 63,000 infants from 2003 to 2006. Now again, Moderna phase 2 is underway, will not be concluded before the summer. Phase 3 will begin this summer, will not be concluded before November. Phase 3 will begin this summer, and point being that the results will not be in. And as the authors write, skipping down, there is another scenario that is far more ominous. 3 months after the NIH trials begin in July, mid-October, studies reveal many patients are developing high levels of antibodies to the coronavirus without severe side effects, as the White House did with its relentless promotion of hydroxychloroquine as a cure. It would badger the FDA to permit use of the vaccine. More pressure would come from drug companies, some of whom may spend up to $1 billion on research and are intensely competing for prestige and glory. They are planning to begin manufacturing their vaccine candidates at risk, that is, before completed studies showing their vaccine is actually effective. Skipping down. An emergency authorization would allow Mr. Trump to hold his news conference and declare victory. But like President George W. Bush's mission accomplished proclamation, it has the potential to be a travesty. Millions of vaccines could be distributed without proof that the vaccine can prevent disease or transmission. Even if a vaccine generates antibodies, it does not prove that the vaccine is effective at preventing infection. And even with the initial trials, we are likely to have scant data on whether older people will mount an immune reaction and be protected. And that leaves aside whatever undesirable side effects might result. And RNA vaccines have been cited as being highly risky in that regard. So the point being that there may be a vaccine October surprise sprung on us, and that the timetables and regulations, the oversight of this vaccine development, is altogether inadequate. This concludes For the Record program number 1134, BioPsyOp Apocalypse Now Part 9, Miscellaneous Updates on COVID-19, being recorded on June 15th of 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.